Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be discussing the brutal noir thriller You Were Never Really Here, as well as hearing from the film's writer-director, Lynn Ramsey. And really here with me this week is regular contributor Kelly Powell.
Hello.
And irregular contributor Campbell A. Campbell.
Hello.
Welcome to your first Curzon Podcast.
Thrilled to be here.
Okay, so before we get into the film and before we hear from Lynn Ramsey, we have an email from Min Kyu Kim, who says, I finally saw Lady Bird today with a friend to whom I had promised that I would wait until she got back to London for a weekend from uni. We both just absolutely loved it, and as students, Lady Bird's Leaving for College hit home particularly hard. And at the end, after a few sniffles, we both excused each other to call our respective mothers. Later, I walked my friend back to Waterloo, where I waved her off feeling much like Laurie Metcalf's character at the airport, and listened to your podcast on the way home as consolation. I've been a regular listener for some time, but today it felt extra relevant and poignant, so thank you guys. And he has wants to shout out to his dear pal Sophia, who didn't have Wi-Fi on the train to listen as well, apparently. Thank you very much for reaching out to us, Min. Much appreciated. And as ever, if you do want to send us a review for us to read out on next week's show, of the film we're discussing this week or a film we've discussed in the past, please do so to podcast@curzon.com and we'll read out your review on next week's show. So, based on the novel by Jonathan Ames, You Were Never Really Here stars Joaquin Phoenix as Joe, a man hired to rescue a young girl from a seedy criminal underworld. And despite having only made 4 feature films, Lynn Ramsey has become one of the most recognisable auteurs working today. So we sent our very own Jake Cunningham to speak to her last week.
So we're very excited to welcome Lynn Ramsey onto the Curzon Film Podcast. You doing all right?
Yeah, I'm fine.
So this is actually very special for me to sit down and talk to you today because the first film that I studied after I left school just at Sixth Form College was Morven Colour.
Wow, oh, that's cool. That's great. I haven't seen it for years and I was doing a thing up in Glasgow Film Festival with Edith Bowman about music and there was a clip of it and it just made me want to watch the film. And then I saw Samantha Morton last night. She came to the screening, you know, because she's so amazing in that film. And so it was a really special experience that. So I'm glad that that's great. You know,
like for me, that's like a really significant part of my education because it was the first time that someone kind of told me that you can think of a film as being more than just something that you can just watch. Yeah. So being able to sit here and talk to you is really lovely. So that film was an education for me. And I wonder in that time how you've been educated by your own films, like over that, what is it, 15,
20, well,
20
years,
years now.
I know, God. Like,
what have you learned over that time that you've brought, or what have you brought from Morven Colour that you found in You Were Never Really Here, maybe?
Well, I started doing shorts when I was pretty young, you know, and you know, Morven Colour, it was an amazing experience. Like, and I remember we shot, because I've shot all my films in film, you know, like apart from this one, this is digital, but we made it, I think we, you know, gave it, I did a lot of tests in this but you know, it's real discipline shooting in film, you know, like you can't just run the camera for ages, you know, it's like that's film stock, it's like,
and that's things money.
Yeah, it's money, you know, and I remember in Morven Colour, it was like, the producer sort of sweating in the corner, you know, like, because it was really hard to cut in that film because she was so mesmeric. And I think there's some similarity between Joaquin and Sam, you know, they're very instinctive, like, you know, I always talk to my actors during prep, but like the ones I've worked with, like John C. Reilly, Tilda, Asia, Sam, you know, they've always, like, once we kind of, when it clicks, you know, and we're jamming, it's not, we don't do rehearsals, it's like, it's much more, they just go inside the characters, you know. And he's, it was so exciting to watch him. I mean, we'd hardly any time to shoot, and it was like, I really had the feeling of what's he going to do next, which I really wanted in the film. So one minute it could be really blackly funny, and the next minute I remember there was one shot he was walking, like, it's after there's a water scene, and it's just a shot where he's walking towards camera, and it was like hell is coming, you know. It was like the demon, you know. It was like, it was just exciting for the crew and I to watch this. Like, it was a really young crew. A lot of them were ex-NYU students and ex-Columbia students, and some of them were directors, which I didn't know at the beginning. And the script supervisor was a director, the AD was a scriptwriter, and like they were excited by the film, and that really buoyed me up as well. Like, because it was a brutal shoot. It was like, you don't want to be shooting in the summer in New York. It's like horrendous. That's why everyone leaves, you know, yeah. to go to, you know, the Hamptons yeah. or whatever, you know.
And it was, as I understand, a pretty brutal pre-production as well. From when you actually found out you're going to be shooting in August, there's only a little bit of time from when Joaquin agreed. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, it was a small. I mean, luckily we had this really quite. I mean, there was this, the guy that was financing the film really was one of those guys that could just say, right, like, you can go ahead. You know, I mean, you don't always get that opportunity. So thanks to Pascal Cochot, who I've probably pronounced his name wrong, Cochot, I think. Yeah. He was able to say, yeah, if you want to do it, you can do it now, you know. And Joaquin said yes, but he had another film. And then it was like, or do you wait a year? And I'm like, oh, this is a no-brainer. Like, it's Joaquin, I'm doing it, you know. Mm. And I think the prep that Tom and I, the DP, and Tim Grimes, the production designer, and Paul Davis, especially the sound designer, and Johnny, like, they'd done, because the script had a lot of images and sound written in, you know, had really helped, because I don't think I would have been able to do it in that time otherwise, you know, like, because Tom knew it like the back of his hand, Paul knew it really well, you know, like, so the sounds and a lot of things were kind of prepped when I was writing the script, you know.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask about that, because I think your relationship with Tom Townend is quite interesting, with working with cinematography right at the writing stage almost. So could you go into what that process is like, or did he come and write with you, or was he like there with a camera?
No, it would be, I think every now and again, I was living in Greece in Santorini, like, at the time, and every now and again I'd be like, right, I got to this place, and so he'd come and we'd talk about it, and then, you know, I'd kind of like, you know, that would spin off other ideas, you know. So it was a kind of visual co-writing in a way, you know, like a visual writing kind of thing. And I've known him for like 25 years. He operated Morven Caller, you know, like he shot The Stellars and Ratcatcher. And so there's a kind of shorthand with him where, like, he thinks like a camera, you know. You can go, there's a way that I think he can think in economy images, and he knows he's a real cinephile as well. So sometimes he says films I don't even know what he's talking about, you know what I mean? Like, he's a smart ass, you know, but in the greatest possible way. But I think that was a real asset in something like this when you have no time. It's like, I hadn't worked with him for a while, and I've been really lucky with the DPs. Like, Alvin Kukler did Ratcatcher and Morven Caller, and he's amazing, and now, you know, he's biggest DP, one of the biggest DPs in the world. But Ratcatcher was his first feature. Tom was did Stellars in that. Tom, you know, like, operating Morven. I worked with Seamus McGarvey, who's an amazing, like, huge DP as well. And then Daddy's Congee, I almost worked with. And Natasha Breyer as well, this Argentinian DP who shot this short film called The Swimmer for me, was just phenomenal. So everyone brings a different flavour to different pieces. But I think with this particular film, it was Tom knew how strongly I felt about film. And like, we did a lot of tests, and, you know, because I hadn't shot digital before, and that, when I saw what he was doing in the grade, I was like, yeah, he really got the film right from early on.
So looking more to the film as a whole, You Were Never Really Here kind of looks at the character of the lone ex-cop. He's on a hunt for justice. It's an area that's been pretty well covered in film before. What about that type of character interests you? And I suppose more importantly, where did you see your angle on that character?
Well, I always hate seeing the synopsis of this film. I mean, yeah. I think other people write these things and I'm like, what? You know, because it's a very experiential film. It's like kind of hard to describe, and that's why I make films probably, you know. But on paper, yeah, you know, it's a, you know, novellas, I mean, it's really, he's a great writer, Jonathan Ames. Like, you know, he can write comedy. He wrote this book called I Pass Like Night that's a bit like Holden Caulfield, like gone more wrong, you know, later on. He knows New York this like really well. It's like it's a really authentic kind of voice of New York, you know, as well. And so he knew he was writing a pulpy B novel, but he can't really do that either because it's such like there's something in the way he writes that never is that. And you know, I said to him, I'm going to do my own thing with it, and he was like totally up for that. And he said, all I want is that it feels like the way you felt so compelled, like I read it in 90 minutes probably, or a couple hours, and do you know what I mean, like how compelling it felt. You just, you know, as long as it's got that feeling that you felt when you read it. And I was like, yeah, that's what I want too. But it was really the character of Joe that was interesting to me. It was like that it's a kind of man in midlife crisis, a man like sort of spiraling, you know, his sanity's like, you know, he's kind of like, he's going to seed a bit, you know, like there was everything that was against the kind of types of this trope. He's not like the six-pack guy, he's not the knight, he can hardly save himself, you know what I mean, like, you know, rather than anyone else. And I think that we're all the ingredients were there for a really, really interesting character that is like not the one you're used to seeing in a film like this, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And so we talked about you, collaborator Tom, and the writer Jonathan Ames there. Looking at the music, which is Johnny Greenwood, audiences listening to this are lucky enough to go to the cinema and be able to hear two Johnny Greenwood scores at once, which is a pretty exciting prospect.
It is. I mean, like, especially because they're so different, which just shows you how talented he is. I mean, but, you know, because Johnny's still, you know, he's so like a kid, you know, like a child with music. He's like, you know, it excites him so much. And you know, he's a really modest guy as well. And, you know, I sent him a rough cut of Kevin, and that's how that relationship started. And he got back really quickly and he was like, this film really scares me and I don't know why, but I'm really into it. And it's like started from there. And and then this one, yeah, I sent him the script, but we didn't know it was going to go so fast, you know. So I was like, oh, maybe I'm making it, and you know, I'm still working in the ends, and which I was, and then he was in tour with Radiohead, so I was like, I don't know if he didn't know if he could do it, you know, but we just kind of figured out a way, you know, and it was more remotely than we'd done Kevin, but strangely, it was just like I was giving him like in chronological order. The reels, you know, so he's like, what's going to happen, you know, where's it going to go, you know, and it kind of had him in tenter hooks, I think, a bit as well, where was this character going, and then the score became a bit like the character, like you think you're in one thing and it goes somewhere else, and it's like, then it implodes a bit and comes back, you know.
Well, it's so, really, you go on a really surprising journey with the music, because there are, maybe near the beginning, you think you're in a regular kind of Johnny Greenwoody world that we're used to hearing of his kind of music, and then these kind of synth waves come in, and it's the most lush, beautiful thing.
No, it really, his score became Joe, you know, and the first like kind of like piece of score in the film like defines Joe as a character. It's slightly, you know, it's him walking down a corridor and he's like, you know, it's really ominous, and then it's all out of whack, you know, and then it goes somewhere much more that you think, all right, I'm in a thriller, a genre, and then it smashes it up, and then it comes back. It's just like I can't even describe it. But every time the editor and I got our track, because he doesn't score to picture, which I find really interesting, because what happens? Because I start my soundtrack really early. I start working in sound. I'll do a cut, then I'll work in sound, then I'll use what I've learned about sound to recut. You know, like, so rather than doing like the sound all comes at the end.
So were you temp tracking? With
I was pre-mixing. We bought this mixing desk, which met like in LA where I was working, like, which sounds all glamorous, but it was, and it was like the editor and I were in his back bedroom or something, And I was like, should we try and mix it as we go? And we bought some sort of mixing desk off the computer, off the internet. And it was like his computer completely died and he lost all his work. So it was like completely horrific, you know, all because of this stupid mixing desk. But right from the beginning, it was like we were working on the sound, you know, and then Johnny would send these tracks, and the editor and I were almost like running up and down the corridors of the cutting room, you know, like, you know, jumping for joy. We were just like, we were so astounded by some of it. And then we cut to his music rather than the, you know, he would cut to our picture. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So it was really like it was always like a kind of like you're like a birthday every time you got like some like something sent to
that's
you.
It. I think,
you know?
Paul Thomas Anderson had the same thing. He just on a different time zone, wake up in the morning, and there's an email from Johnny Greenwood. There's not much better to receive.
No, it was like you're just super excited to open this present you get. You know, like, and it was, so those days became some audio files came. Joe and I were always really, really excited, and then that really informed the cut as well, you know. So it was a really organic thing with the sound and the music, and then the sound design as well, you know. That was another layer that was happening really early on. Yeah. And luckily we had Graeme Stewart, who was Johnny's engineer, and he was music editing on this as well. And so he knew the tracks inside out as well. And so having Graeme as well was really key to this, yeah.
And I think I didn't see the what I'm sure will go down as the can cut of this film, but I understand it's the sound is probably the biggest difference. Is that right? From what people might have seen 10 months ago?
Well, it was, you know, I felt a little bit, it was a catch-22 can, you know, because it was great. I mean, don't get me wrong, like, but the script is like, it was the year before that the script, Amazon bought the script in Cannes, like, and that was great and everything, and they really liked it and stuff, and that, but there was no way on earth I thought the next year at Cannes I'd be there, you know. And it's such an honour to get into Cannes, but I was just working away in the film. I think Pascal felt like the film was getting in quite good shape and must have just shown them it, you know, just to see what they thought, and they were like, we want it, and it, but it had like storyboards in it, and you know, like, it wasn't mixed. And so there was two additional days I put aside that because there's no tank in New York to do center stuff, and then suddenly I had to prep a shoot it, cut it, mix it, and do that before Cannes, you know. But the saving grace was I didn't get nervous about Cannes because I was too exhausted. I was exhausted when I was there. It was just like 24/7, you know. But then suddenly you're in this audience with like thousands of people, and it's an amazing sound system. And I could feel the audience were kind of going with it. But we mixed the film in 5 days. I mean, I thought I had post-traumatic stress because of the gunshots again and again and again. I had to go outside sometimes. And, you know, like, because we were really experimenting with the sound. But the brilliant thing is that we got a pre-mix. Like, you don't normally get two goes at a mix, you know. But then everyone liked it after Cannes, so it was like, I was kind of promised more cutting time, and it was like, no, but everyone loves it. And I'm like, nah, I have to, like, some of the stuff we shot later needs finessed, you know?
Yeah.
So I thought we'd have more cutting time, but in the end, we just made it work, and we spent most of the time in the mixing and the music, you know.
All right. So we've probably got time for one last question. So I read an interview the other day that... you said they won't ask you to do Batman, but you could. So I've got to ask, if you could pick your Batman, who would you cast?
Oh, I've got to say, I don't know. Well, Joker, I don't know. I don't know. I'll keep it under wraps for now. I think Joaquin and anything, and there's a few others that I think, you know. I think I wouldn't go the obvious route, put it that way, you know. It's hard to say, you know, but, you know, I remember, like, I loved Alan Moore's work when I was a kid, and, like, my boyfriend at the time, when I was, you know, a teenager, was really into, you know, like, everything. Like, his room was so full of comic books, you had to have there's a special path to walk. So he got me The Dark Knight and The Watchmen, the original editions, and my mum... years later I said, where are they? She chucked them out. They're probably worth a fortune.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's like sometimes, like, things in articles are slightly taken out of context and stuff like that. But yeah, I think if you've got, you can do the movie in your way, and it would be interesting, you know, like, and some people have said this film as a kind of graphic novel type of,
yeah,
you know,
I
like
can totally
rhythm.
See that.
But maybe that was influenced by sort of like reading those things when I was a kid and stuff, you know.
Brilliant. Lynn Ramsey, thanks so much. Cheers.
But Joaquin Phoenix in anything.
Yeah.
Basically.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Okay, so that was Jake speaking to writer and director of You Were Never Really Here, Lynn Ramsey. So we quickly went over the plot just before the interview there. It sounds very conventional when you say it out loud. I mean, it feels like something that could very easily star Liam Neeson, be produced by Luc Besson, it could be a Taken sequel or something. But why isn't this that film?
Because of Lynn Ramsey.
The Ramsey effect, baby.
Right?
it's all in her style, in that she's always had like this very keen eye for photography in her films. And with You Were Never Really Here, it kind of bleeds through here, where it's very much about building character through image and editing rather than it is necessarily about a twisty noir plot.
Or seems like plot's kind of secondary to what she's trying to do in I think in all of her films, really. It's more, we were speaking about this earlier, but she really wants to sort of delve into character, and her films are very, very, you know, they're character studies. They're very specific to character, what they're going through, their point of view. It feels like this whole film is, you know, she puts us into the mindset of Joe, and what the world sort of looks like from his perspective. And it sort of like throws you in the deep end and makes you, you know, scramble to make sense of the world, just like Joe sort of does, you know, his trauma coming to bear.
From what I understand, the book is very much this kind of hard-boiled noir thriller about a kind of hitman sent off to a mission, and there's all this political intrigue about these conspiracy and all these plot twists and turns. And I overheard someone who was at the screening we were at yesterday for this film talking about how in the book the political subplot is far more prevalent, and it goes into far more detail about the politician character in the book. And I think Lynn Ramsey isn't as interested in the plot as perhaps the person reading the book might be. She's more interested about how do we look at the world, a world where this thing would happen, and how do we look at a character who would do the things that he does in the book.
Yeah, as with as you and Kelly have said, like a lot of Ramsey's work is very concerned with kind of character and trauma. And the funny thing is that, like, with a lot of the plot of her films, they just kind of serve as these backdrops into which she then explores these characters' psyches. So like the political kind of backdrop kind of just like feeds into this kind of like creeping paranoia that you kind of feel with all of these flashing images of like whatever past violence that Joe has experienced. We only catch glimpses, so like the more it kind of descends into this kind of twisty kind of noir plot, the more we kind of get into his shoes as we kind of feel increasingly paranoid about this stuff. And she's such a master of just kind of building this kind of visceral reaction just through leaving us to observe these images.
I really like that as well, that she doesn't spoon feed at all, you know. It's her films are like, I mean, it's been said before, but they are like visual poetry, you know. She puts the images there. I mean, it's just, it unfolds as she wants it to, and she doesn't spoon feed anything to you. She wants you to work it out, and you put it together the way that you need to read it, you know, like and that kind of makes it more engaging, and makes it more of like a personal cinema-going experience, I think.
And even Joe's background. And so Joe is this Joaquin Phoenix's character who, from the off, we know, I think the best way to describe Joe is someone who's not okay
in not any okay level. In any way, level. Yeah.
And even the kind of the context of why the trauma he's suffered, it's stuff we have seen before in films. You know, he was in the army, he was an FBI agent, he was from an abusive family.
Mm.
But she doesn't spell it out for you. I mean, some of these are told in like really quick shots that you almost miss. I think you could very easily miss the fact that he was in the FBI.
Yeah.
I think you could watch the film and pay a lot of attention to it, and that could just pass you by.
Exactly.
I completely missed using the FBI.
Well, because it's not important, right? It's not important for plot. It's not important. Yeah. It's more of like these are things that are swimming around in his head from past experience, and they sort of come to fruition as memory does, you know, sort of subconsciously. Mm. It's all there, and he accesses it. It comes up in moments that he doesn't want it to or expect it to. And that's sort of like trauma, right?
Yeah.
So like comes up in fragment. It's fragmented and compartmentalized in his mind. And that's the way that she kind of visually represents it to us. You know, fragments of past trauma that like he's dealing with, and we have to deal with the visual assault of that just as he kind of does, you know?
I love like the most important kind of thing about the film is that the trauma and pain is more real than any story that we can kind of throw at it. Like
exactly.
With his military background, it's just dropped at us in this. It's like a couple of shots or something, and these images inform like how you feel about his character, and the why and how isn't entirely important as like the fact that it did happen.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of these moments where just a singular image will kind of be used to kind of build this character. Well, she kind of leads us to this understanding, but just by kind of showing us some stuff, but not really pushing us toward, not entirely pushing us towards a specific feeling, but just pushing us towards a feeling.
Yeah, that's kind it's kind of metaphorical in a way, like the way that she uses detail, the way that she drops back, like the plastic bag thing. I don't think it's a spoiler. I think it's not a spoiler.
It's introduced early.
It's introduced early, and it's basically like he's asphyxiating him. It's like a sadomasochistic, right? Like he has many suicidal thoughts in this film.
That we see, that are
visually represented. And I feel like she works in these kinds of like the details she uses are on purpose. It's visually representing how he's suffocating under the weight of, you know, these memories and the trauma, and it's like his fragmented psyche, how these memories rush back further, complicating the way that he sees the world.
I guess it even extends to his weapon of choice. We were talking about this earlier with the hammer.
Mm-hmm.
As Ramsay does, like kind of in close-up. Mm-hmm. Close-up?
extreme close-up.
In extreme close-up, we see Made in the USA, like on the side of this hammer. And it's another symbol of things that have happened to him in the past. We see other people using hammers.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that kind of just that poetic kind of matching of these images shows us a lot about why Joe commits these violent acts in the way he does.
Mm.
And a lot of these just simple shot matches or just a quick cut to something it's crazy how informative that Ramsay makes just these very simple techniques.
She uses cinema so beautifully, man. Like she, like cinema language. She understands cinema language to the nth degree, I think.
It's pure cinema.
There you go.
I did air quotes.
So let's talk a bit more about Joe and Joaquin Phoenix, who, you know, has quite a diverse career, I think it's fair to say. And I think he chooses films very specifically, very carefully. Why do you think he is the perfect Joe?
I think with a lot of Ramsay's films, like how we've been saying about how she's kind of very focused on image rather than telling, she's picked the perfect actor in Joaquin Phoenix is that he always has these very transformative kind of physical roles where you could be, like for example, he's got another film in which he sports a giant beard, but just even from like glimpses of that, you can see kind of that he carries himself in such a different way. And in this, he's just kind of this hulking, like monstrous presence. Yeah.
Are you referring to Mary Magdalene, where he plays
yes,
Jesus?
I am. Maybe the exact opposite of Joe, but still heavily bearded. But yeah, there's so much down to how he just kind of carries himself, and he does he has very little dialogue, as with a lot of other Ramsay protagonists. But what she does is she kind of just leaves us to infer a lot about them, not just from kind of images that she's showing us of like just kind of close-up details of things, but also we are left to look at how, like, very closely at how these actors perform. So, like, a lot of her works are kind of defined by these very stone-faced lead characters, like Samantha Morton and Morven Callor, or James Gillespie, maybe? I think that's his name. The boy who plays the lead in Ratcatcher. Mm. We're left to infer a lot just from kind of micro-expressions or just the way they move. Like I said before, with Joaquin just almost contorting himself in these roles to get into this character, I think it's kind of a match made in heaven, really.
You feel, it speaks to his character, right? It's like he doesn't say anything in life either. People just sort of, I noticed that with the exchange with the shopkeeper, whatever that was. I don't even think I understand that relationship, to be honest. What? I don't know why he was paying him.
I think he was kind of a middleman.
Yeah,
for getting him his jobs.
Oh,
so he's
middle management.
I'm not really sure what his job is, like what he would call himself, on like a business card or anything.
It's like maybe a private.
It's just like a kind of, you know, in these films, like these crime films, say, oh, he's a guy that'll get the job done,
he's
kind of thing.
He's
a hired hand,
hired gun,
hired hammer.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway. There's like, he doesn't talk, he doesn't have to speak, you know, his physical presence, his presence says it all, you know, and people understand him based on that, like characters within the story and us as the audience, we understand like, and how he interacts within the frame. And they were talking, I watched a little bit of the Cannes conference, and they specifically spoke about his sort of physical presence and how they wanted him to be the antithesis of this Hollywood hero type that's sort of like chiseled and like, you know, the kind of protagonist that we would see in a Taken kind of a film. And you know how he is huge. They wanted him to be big.
Physically
big and imposing and have this sort of, he's just kind of hulking through life. But he's still, you know, he's still vulnerable. You can see that he's broke. His body is as broken as his mind, really. You know, like, and it's failing him, I think. Which is interesting because he has to deal with sort of injuries the whole film.
He's an action hero.
But he's
covered in scars and bruises. I mean, the scars are horrible. Like, they're really thick. They look uncomfortable to bear.
Feels real. Yeah, exactly.
It's not like an elegant scar over the
eye.
No.
Yeah, and he won Best Actor at Cannes for this.
Well, yeah, deservedly so, I reckon.
I'd say,
He's phenomenal in this film.
The Wok.
This film is so good, guys.
So I think a lot of people are comparing the film to Taxi Driver, and Joe is very much this kind of... is it Paul Schrader that described Travis Bickle as God's lonely man or something along those lines? And I think Joe is very much the God's lonely man type character. Very internal.
I don't think God exists in this world.
God is dead and Travis killed him.
Yeah, exactly. Or Joe did.
Exactly.
It was a team effort.
Yeah, exactly.
Now there's a movie.
Yeah. You were never really talking to me.
Yes. Nice. But yeah, so you've got this lonely protagonist who's very internal, very driven, very violent, a young girl in trouble. There's a lot of driving through the city, these like dark, murky city streets. You could very much have like Travis Bickle's monologue over some of the shots in this film where he's in the back of a cab looking at the city and looking at the police, you know, quartering off a corner where a dead body is there or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I think the key difference is that the way the film presents violence.
It's, I feel that Joe is very much like a post-shooting Travis Bickle. Whereas Taxi Driver kind of is building towards the radicalization of... who is ultimately a very hateful man, just kind of like filled with kind of racism and misogyny. Whereas it seems that kind of Joe is haunted by and is very like stuck in a moment like post that shooting where he's like trying to escape kind of violence. And the film kind of matches that by just seemingly shrinking away from it. Like the camera lingers on everything but violence. So we'll see like the kind of grotesque aftermath. Or yeah. There's a, there's a really horrible scene with someone's hands.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
No spoiler.
That's so true. That's so true. Actually, I never thought about it. You never see the actual... Like, you see...
You do, but it's not very... It's not like...
It's brief.
It's brief, and yeah. it's in a shadow or...
Yeah, like, or in a broken mirror. Yeah, or, like, yeah. You see glimpses of it, I think.
I think the film... It's like the film is, like, ashamed that it's violent. It doesn't want to be proud of its violence.
Yeah, like Joe, I think. Yeah.
I mean, with Taxi Driver, I mean, Travis Bickle is someone who aspires to be violent and thinks... To survive in this world, in the New York that I have to see every day, you have to be violent. You have to go outside the law.
That violence is the answer.
Yeah. Whereas, and a lot of films like that and like Taken are sold on their violence and how cool the violence is and how kick-ass Liam Neeson is or something. And yet here, the film's biggest action set piece, if you want to call it that, is filmed entirely through a CCTV camera.
Yeah.
Like four different shots that it cuts back and forth to. And that actually makes it really difficult to see what's going on and tell what's going on. Because I don't think Lynn Ramsey wants you to see how cool the violence is. Doesn't want to sensationalize the violence.
Which is, which is interesting that the detail of that made in the USA shot with a hammer. You know, that's ironic, right? That, like, that he uses that and then she's trying to say, basically, that, like, specifically Hollywood's relationship to, I don't know if she's trying to say this, but I'm reading this. Like, you know, the
but
way that, like,
anyway.
You know, movies and the way violence is portrayed and, like, how sort of America in general sort of accepts and justifies a lot of violence in many ways and glorifies that, I'd say, in a lot of Hollywood film, that this is the kind of antithesis of that, like, that kind of...
Look how horrible this is to say, not look how cool this is.
Yeah.
I guess.
Or look at what it does. Look at what it can do. You know, how it can break you, how it can break a person or a society or... Yeah. I don't know, maybe that's lame.
No, I was thinking that's where it kind of circles back to Taxi Driver, where Travis wants to be a cowboy, like, so bad. Kind of just this mythical American hero, and he's kind of... Because, I mean, he gets a revolver.
Yeah.
he's earned... when he's kind of staring in the mirror at himself and he's, like, kind of bigging himself up and creating this image, it feels like You Were Never Really Here is kind of a deconstruction of that, of what, like, kind of violent... What damage, like, violence does. It doesn't, like... Well, both kind of show that, like, it's not something aspirational and aspiring to violence is dangerous. And how it kind of... It can kind of lead to these acts that kind of can shatter both your mind and the lives of, like, people around you. And it's, like...
Destructive.
Yeah. And it kind of, especially, even, like, right down to, like, the structure of the film, it just feels like someone's literally taken a hammer, just, like, smashed the plot in half.
So true.
And just, like, there's just fragments
and it's
of,
put
like,
together. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The fragments of that have been put together in this film.
Yeah.
I like that metaphor.
And there's so much blood in the film. But you don't really see, like, in many, like, entry wounds or anything like that.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, like, there's a lot of, like, 12A action films that have a lot of violence but no blood, which is maybe kind of problematic for younger people to not see the consequence of what actually happens
when
a gun goes off or when someone gets punched or anything like that. And this is showing mainly concern about what happens after the gun goes off or the hammer is, you know, dealt its blow with actually seeing the blow.
And the fact that he uses a hammer rather than a gun, you know,
that's
being
horrible.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like Ramsey has a penchant for just focusing in on these, like I said before, like these really grotesque details. And one of those is kind of like right at the beginning of the film, just him cleaning the hammer. Like even with the whole just like, yeah, he's done the job. Now he's getting out of here. Like thing. There's just like this very horrible implication of like just. What has gone down, even if
without
it's like,
seeing it, even
it makes violence very difficult, and it does a really great job of just kind of reconciling with that.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it reminds me of something that Jonathan Demme said about Silence of the Lambs. This is the director of Silence of the Lambs, who sadly passed away last year. But he said that the end shootout between Clarice and Buffalo Bill was shot in such a way that he didn't want the audience to cheer when what happens. He didn't want them to cheer for someone dying in a film. And I feel like that's the same here. Like in a lot of films, again, it's like set up that you cheer when the good guy kills the bad guy.
Right. When violence is the answer. Yeah.
I think they want the audience to go, yes, finally, it's the good guys have won. Or whatever. Yeah, and this is another example where she doesn't want you to cheer when Joe barges in and whatever.
Does his thing.
Because it's a hideous thing that he's doing.
Exactly.
So, we talked a lot about Joe there, but there is also a very interesting supporting cast as well. Mm-hmm. So, Ekaterina Samsonov as Nina, who is the kidnapped girl he's sent to save. His mother is a really interesting character. She's never named. She's just called Joe's mother. She's played by Judith Roberts, who most people probably recognise from Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
That's the one with the wee thought of the most. What did you think of their relationship?
Stop me from despairing in the cinema. It's really interesting that one of the biggest takeaways from the film is that Joaquin Phoenix is this kind of hulking nightmare creature, but like one of the first interactions he actually had that we actually see him have with a human being is with his elderly mother, and it's just this very warm and kind of tender thing. Again, he transforms just a little bit. He like kind of carries himself more lightly in these scenes where he's just kind of messing around and making references to like Psycho of all things, and just kind of. Generally just kind of
he's very protective over her in a different kind of a way.
And I like that he wears pajamas. He was wearing these like very childlike pajamas when the next morning, which I think was interesting. And there's the scene where like she uses the shower wrong, he cleans up after her. I think it's a sort of a very pleasant relationship, like one of the only ones in the film. But then she has them. Lynn Ramsey's carefully selected that the mum is watching Psycho when he comes home, and I don't know what that means. But I mean,
dysfunctional. I think
you have a relationship between a mother and a son, and she's chosen to have the mother watch and then discuss Psycho, which is the ultimate mother-son movie in many ways.
Yeah,
I guess like the main thing that I'd kind of take from Psycho being the family film of choice, because Psycho kind of at its core is about. This is kind of very intense relationship between a past mother and son. I can't remember the first name of the mother, but Mrs. Bates.
I don't remember.
Norman kind of kills on behalf of Mrs. Bates. Mm. And in this, Joe's Joe's kind of motivation to kind of commit these violent acts is kind of rooted in a number of things. Mm. And his relationship with his mother is kind of, it's kind of inferred to be a part of that.
Mm.
And we see that what seemingly unrelated images like the hammer drip fed to us like throughout. Yeah. So and I feel like Psycho.
I think it's also like making reference to the fact that they've got this connection with each other that's rooted in trauma, that they've gone through something together, you know, their past, that has linked them in this dysfunctional way. I think maybe that's just a reference to their sort of connection and their violent history together.
Yeah. And the things like the song they sing together and...
the cleaning cutlery together, like that's such a banal thing to be doing. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Polishing the silverware, exactly.
Yes.
But it's sweet, you know, like it's... and it is a bit of a reprieve from the rest of the film. It's like gives a
you need it
quality.
You really need
yeah,
it.
That
yeah.
You're like, oh god, I'm actually human. Yeah. I love that real things happen in life.
And that reprieve comes within the first 5 minutes.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Like,
oh god, I need a breather.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, yeah. What's great about the film is that it's 1 hour and 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Which, first of all, more films should be 1 hour and 25 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
But also, it makes it that much more relentless, I suppose, in everything it does. It doesn't slow down. It doesn't give you a chance.
Yeah.
We're saying it was a nice reprieve, but then after that, it doesn't give you a chance to kind of sit back and take a breath.
Yeah.
It feels like the first drop on a roller coaster, but
forever. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Much like life, like a roller coaster.
Oh, yeah.
And we've seen the film twice now, and the first time we saw it was a slightly different version of the ultimate one that's being released. That's right.
The Ramsey cut.
The Ramsey cut.
I think it was it's an intense experience kind of both times. The version that I saw last October at London Film Festival was kind of, I wouldn't call it like a rough cut. It was just, there was a very small thing missing and they spruced up the sound the second time around. But I just kind of, just because of that, like kind of, you can't call it a minor change because the sound informs the film so much, but it just kind of, that slight bit more overwhelming this time around. And there's a shot near the end, which kind of didn't entirely change the impact of the ending for me, but kind of just, I walked out of it feeling slightly differently to how I did the first time. I'd think for the better.
Yeah.
And this is a version that everyone will see. It was interesting how much just these tweaks to the sound design and sound mixing, I guess, just changed how the film lands, like, throughout just the voices. And
The sound is phenomenal in this film.
So good.
Mm-hmm. And not just, the soundtrack by Johnny Greenwood is great, but then there's also the non-diegetic sound as well. Like when he crushes a jelly bean between his fingers and, like, the sort of the crunching of it.
It kind of draws our attention, like how you said earlier, how we're being dropped into kind of the psyche of Joe. The sound does so much heavy lifting in that, just all of these kind of unimportant, like, everyday sounds just kind of, it just feels like
exacerbated.
It just, like, feels like nails on a chalkboard. Yeah. And then there's also at the same time kind of these non-diegetic sounds, like his maybe the wax own voice combined with just kind of memories. Just associated by sound, and you're just kind of hearing this, like, kind of barrage of just noises, and, like, they could be in the background at any point. Sometimes they're just kind of cranked up, and then at the same time you just have this completely erratic and atonal soundtrack by Johnny Greenwood just kind of hammering away.
Yeah.
And it kind of turns, like, what might have been maybe, I guess, I don't know, a more, I wouldn't call it like a reflective thing, but it kind of turns it into this kind of very active, ongoing nightmare, rather than just it puts us even more in his shoes than it would have if we were just quietly watching.
Can't escape
him.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, like, kind of all consuming.
Which makes you empathize with him so much more. Like, he's doing atrocious things, but, like, you get it. You empathize with him. You know, you get it. You're like, imagine that was you. Oh, God. Imagine living in that nightmare.
The soundtrack is interesting because there's not much consistency with it. I mean, there's a kind of a theme, but he uses so many different instruments in so many different ways that it's hard to, if you heard it all, you might think it's set various different soundtracks, like, on one album, but it's
whatever the method that got us to this point, it just kind of encompasses all of these different genres and, like, just a lot. Sometimes it just feels like it's like noise. Yeah. Like, one of the first things we see, here is just kind of this mess of different guitar noises. Mostly, a lot of them sound like they're kind of out of tune, or someone's just kind of bashing it against a wall. And then it'll change, like, from that one minute into this kind of fairly smooth, kind of electronic tune the next. And it never rests on one point. And I think part of this, to me, goes hand in hand with Ramsey's kind of inclination to not lead people to specific feelings, like, rather than instead she lets them kind of take what they will from the film. And this kind of very hard to pin down, not all over the place, but this kind of controlled madness of the soundtrack kind of lets you just kind of sink into the film in those moments. So it kind of creates atmosphere without being overbearing, but it's also overwhelming. It's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. Lot to take in. Mm. Yeah. So, Campbell, you've got a piece for Little White Lies coming out about Lynn Ramsey.
I do. I kind of went through her filmography.
Yeah.
Just bit by bit. So it's kind of these capsules, like,
yeah,
investigating what each film does and what it kind of, the implications it has on the rest of her filmography, and it kind of just builds to a point.
Okay.
It's actually kind of a primer for this. It's just kind of a quick way to understand what her particular style, like, kind of brings to these films. There's a very kind of clear connected thread that I just kind of like.
And how do you see this film in, like, the grand scheme of her so far quite minimal career? She's only made 4 feature films, but she feels like she's been around for ages. Like, she's such a name.
Yeah, she's definitely an auteur. Like, you can definitely tell that's a Lynn Ramsey film, you know?
It seems like she's got a person with a very particular vision. Ewan never really is very, like, no different. This kind of feels like a very obvious on-the-nose thing to say, but it just feels like a very much like a culmination of all of her previous work, because there's very clear threads. Like, you could draw a straight line, maybe some squiggles, between Ratcatcher and this in kind of its willingness to let her camera do the talking, kind of these very dreamlike images and character building through things as small as editing and just kind of these minute, interest in the kind of the minutiae of these characters. I'd say that You Were Never Really Here is just kind of She's kind of taken her she's taken her style overseas.
which didn't quite work out for Jane Got a Gun.
No, it didn't. That was a was one I completely forgot. I knew there was something that.
But I think maybe I don't know. Maybe there's a sense that she had this kind of American genre film that she wanted to explore, and she couldn't quite explore it with Jane Got a Gun. But she's found a medium to do so here in this pulpy thriller.
Yeah, I'd say so. It seems that a lot of her work is kind of rooted in these literary adaptations.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's a deliberate thing, but a lot of the time, say her films like kind of transform like this text into just kind of almost directly into feeling, like by making these images out of them. I don't know how I'm not entirely sure how Jane Got a Gun would sit in that canon, but there's like her abandoned projects like The Lovely Bones, which also had kind of this through line of grief, but
very interested in trauma
and
the way that that's represented formally in her films, I think is very interesting.
Right, so that is You Were Never Really Here, which is out on Friday the 9th of March. But if you feel like staying at home this weekend on Curzon Home Cinema, we have documentary Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story. And also coming to Curzon Home Cinema, we have The Florida Project, which we did a podcast on when it came out a few months ago. We spoke to Sean Baker and Willem Dafoe, so do check that out on our back catalogue. That was one of your films of the year, wasn't it, Kelly?
Yeah, I loved that film.
Yeah.
I loved that film a lot.
Fortunately, Willem Dafoe was not quite successful at the Oscars.
I know. But that film got snubbed, I'm sorry. In general.
So yeah, Florida Project, Bombshell, Hedy Lamarr story, but also on Curzon Home Cinema and still available in cinemas is an actual Oscar winner. That's A Fantastic Woman, which won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. So last week we had the show on that and we spoke to the director, Sebastian Lelio. So go back and check that out. And if you haven't seen the film yet, it's in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema. If you have any thoughts on You Were Never Really Here, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com and we'll read out your review on next week's show. If you're a fan of the show, which you can listen to on iTunes and Acast, please subscribe, leave a review and a comment. So, Campbell O'Campbell, thank you for appearing in your debut show.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly, thank you as ever.
Thank you.
And goodbye from me as well. Thank you very much for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.